The NFL playoffs are better with FanDuel because right now new customers can bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, guaranteed. That's $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. FanDuel, an official sportsbook partner of the NFL. 21 plus and present in select states. First online real money wager only. $5 first deposit required. Bonus issued as non-withdrawable bonus bets which expire 7 days after receipt. Restrictions apply. See terms at sportsbook.fanduel.com. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
89% of business leaders say AI is a top priority. The right choice is crucial, which is why teams at one-third of Fortune 500 companies use Grammarly. Grammarly is the right AI assistant for your team. With top-tier security credentials and 15 years of experience in responsible AI, Grammarly is how companies like yours increase productivity while keeping data protected and private. See why 70,000 teams trust Grammarly at grammarly.com/enterprise.
Welcome, everybody, to another special episode of Positively Trek. I'm Dan Gunther. In this episode, we're going to be talking to author Una McCormick about her Star Trek novel that came out last month, Star Trek Strange New Worlds Asylum. Now, joining me to talk to her are a pair of co-hosts that I haven't had together on the show before. Chrissy DeClercq-Salaghi, whom I have had on the show before, will be joining me, as will Thad Haight, her co-host from the Infinite Diversity podcast. Very thrilled to have them on, and of course very thrilled to have Una McCormick joining us as well. Now, as a lot of you know, Positively Trek has been on a bit of a hiatus for the last little bit of 2024. 2025 is of course just around the corner. This should be going out on New Year's Eve, actually, and we are planning on coming back with new episodes in the new year, including, of course, coverage of the upcoming Star Trek Section 31 movie, and of course, all of the other new Star Trek that will be coming out in 2025, as well as more regular episodes that, unfortunately, we haven't been doing the last little while, but yeah, expect that to change. But for now, I'm very excited to welcome my co-hosts and the guest to the podcast. Joining me to talk about this wonderful book, Star Trek Strange New Worlds Asylum, with the author Una McCormick, is a pair of special co-hosts, one of whom has been on the podcast before. So let's welcome Chrissy DeClercq-Salaghi. Chrissy, how's it going?
I'm good. How are you?
Not too bad.
Looking forward to talking about this book. It's an awesome book.
Yes, absolutely. And also joining us for the first time on Positively Trek, but someone whom I very much admire, Chrissy's co-host of the Infinite Diversity podcast, Thad Haight. Thad, welcome to Positively Trek.
Well, I'm happy to be here. Long-time listener, first-time caller.
Yay! Oh, I'm happy. It's been on my list for ages to get you on the show as well, so I'm glad we were able to do it. We are, of course, as I said, talking about the novel Asylum, and we are so lucky and privileged to have the author on the show with us today, Una McCormick. Una, how's it going?
It's all right. Keep on with the wonderful and the privileged, and we'll get along fine.
Effervescent, beautiful, talented.
Oh, it's wonderful. Keep going. For another 50 minutes, we'll fill the podcast. It's awesome. Very nice to be back. And thank you. I'm always really glad to come on. So thank you.
Oh, excellent. We're always happy to have you. And I love the sentiment of the don't panic. I feel like it's it's of our time.
Yeah, I'm doing a podcast about Douglas Adams a few days after I do this one, but who knows when, you know, this one goes out. So I've been deep diving again into Douglas Adams, and don't panic is very much on my mind. Yeah.
Excellent.
All of us, yeah.
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 Absolutely. Well, as always, the first part of this is going to be spoiler free, but we will get into spoilers fairly quickly. So if you haven't read the novel, be sure to go do that. But you're safe for a few minutes here while we talk a little bit about it. So first of all, the basic premise of this novel, it's Star Trek Strange New Worlds, and it's kind of centered on Una Chin Reilly. So First of all, just a little bit of thrill of finally getting to see Una write for Una.
Indeed. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I think what we were just saying about you, you know, marvelous, wonderful. I tried to do that on as many pages of the book as I could. Una, you're such a brilliant student. Una, I don't know what we'd do without you. Why? I don't know what you would do. Lots and lots of that. But yeah, Una by Una. That's my hashtag for this one.
Oh, that's awesome. And the provenance of that name, too. You have a little bit of involvement in how that character got the name of Una.
Well, involvement in the sense that it's my name. But I didn't maneuver it, so I didn't expect it. So she was given the name Una in the novels by, I think Greg Cox. But they sort of cooked it up together. And that was little homage to me, but obviously number one, it kind of makes sense. It's Una is one in many different languages. And then they picked that up for the show, which was a bit, you know, awesome, because it's, I think I've said this in lots of places, but it's like they torpedoed me back in to the cage, which is pretty good. It's like, you know, there was Star Trek and I was there at the start. Yeah.
That is like, so cool.
Which is pretty cool. As a DS9er as well, obviously a kind of non-linear interaction with the show. So it was really, really cool. And honestly, the first time Anson Mount said my name, I mean, you know, who amongst us would not melt slightly at the thought of that? But it was pretty wonderful. I mean, it was really nice just to have it in the books, but then to kind of get it on screen. And in the subtitles, and it's just awesome.
That's wonderful. So in this novel, we've got two kind of time periods going on. We've got Una back at the academy in her younger days. And then, of course, the present day, whatever we call it, in the midst of basically season two of Strange New Worlds. What was the genesis of this story? Did the idea of the Yuxana Chionian plot come first, or was the idea initially to do a story of Una at the academy?
So the idea was to do a story of Una at the academy. And we were actually, this book was meant to come out after you guys or while you guys were watching season three. But of course, the writer strike hit, and the writer strike did not affect the publication schedule. So we kind of looked at the outline and went, what stays, what goes? And it wasn't too bad. It wasn't too bad. There wasn't too much we had to take out. And basically the shape of the book remained the same. So there are little bits that I just had to go, we've got to go sideways on that one, or, you know, to the right on that one. But it wasn't too bad. But very much the first idea was Una at the academy. The very first idea was Una by Una. Yeah, let's get Una to do a Strange New Worlds book about Una. And then we thought academy. We thought that first meeting with Pike was one that we really wanted to explore, which I think is really rich. And then after we kind of went, well, it's not season, can't be season three, because, you know, can't be. It seemed natural then. In my mind, it's set just after Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow. So it's actually fairly early on in season two, I think. That you wouldn't necessarily get that. I think there's a few references to Lan being a bit twitchy and that kind of thing, or not herself. But really to be dealing with the emotional aftermath of the asylum case. And then once I got the asylum case, I kind of had my central word for the book. And that's where the kind of Yuxana plot line sort of emerged from. So it was Una, and then we kind of went Una Pike, Academy Days, because Academy Days is fun. Everybody loves to see that kind of thing. And then it felt like it always had to be connecting those two moments of the start of that friendship and then where that friendship is after its greatest trial. So that's sort of how we hung it together, I think.
Well, it's very effective. I mean, I love the kind of linking of the two and showing that evolution, the very beginning and then where, like you said, yeah, they have this trial in multiple senses of the word, because their friendship goes through that trial and they come out, thankfully, by the end stronger. But it very easily could have gone the other way. And it's interesting to see that play out from the beginning for sure.
Good. And only two timelines this time. The previous one had three. People got quite cranky about that, so I thought I'll just do two.
That's why you take notes when you're reading. Nothing wrong with that. That's why when you're reading. There's nothing wrong with that.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, I think we are a special kind of person that takes notes when we read. not everybody
probably
does
right
that.
There.
Not taking notes? What's going on here?
There's something about the academic brain that takes notes reading fiction that I just,
There may be a short test. Yeah.
Well, I guess the only other thing I'll say on the spoiler-free side of things was I loved this book. So if you need any further convincing, go out and buy it. It's very, very good. It's Una McCormick. I mean, it's going to be great. Even though Garrick doesn't show up in it. Spoilers, there's no Garrick. Part of me in the back of my mind was like expecting it, but not really.
I couldn't get that to work. I couldn't even get the Cardassians in. You can't really do that with this time period. I think in my head they're there, and everybody's warmly invited to, you know, do the same thing and think, well, what was Garrick's probably a baby or something at this point, is he? Or just a glint in Tane's eye.
Awesome. Positively Trek comes to you each week thanks to the efforts of our amazing Patreon members. If you'd like to help support the show, simply visit patreon.com/positivelytrek. Join at any level to get early access to ad-free episodes and exclusive content. For higher tiers, we offer shoutouts, associate producer credits, and more. We appreciate each and every one of our listeners. Thank you so much for listening to this week's episode. Live long and prosper.
The NFL playoffs are better with FanDuel, because right now new customers can bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, guaranteed. That's $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. FanDuel, an official sportsbook partner of the NFL. 21 plus and present in select states. First online real money wager only. $5 first deposit required. Bonus issued as non-withdrawable bonus bets which expire 7 days after receipt. Restrictions apply. See terms at sportsbook.fanduel.com. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
At Verizon, anyone can trade in their old phone for a new one on us with Unlimited Ultimate, which means everyone in your family could get a new phone and stay on your family plan, keeping you close.
Hey, Mom, you seen my toothbrush?
Yeah, I'm almost done with it.
Oh, maybe too close. Trade-in and additional terms apply. See Verizon.com for details.
This is your official spoiler warning, so we are getting into spoilers at this point. Let's start, I guess, with Una at the Academy, and there's a lot to talk about here. So I guess from you, what was the most interesting part of exploring Una's time at the Academy? Kind of a wide open question there.
Yeah, so I think what I was really interested in exploring was this, that she's living with this lie, yeah? And that she's kind of committed to this lie, this big lie about herself. And she's not a liar, yeah? Una's not that kind of... Una's a very, very straightforward person in many, practically every respect. She's not duplicitous or canny or cagey. She's smart, you know, and handles people well. But in order to be at the Academy, she's living this big lie. And I thought this would be what a horrible situation to find yourself in, to be constantly duplicitous with people around you. If you're a bit of a wicked person, then you don't really care, do you? but Una's not that kind of person. So to be lying to her friends, to instructors, the kind of pressure of this. And I think then I wanted to see a situation in which that became a bit too much and that she didn't live up to her own high expectations of herself, her vision of herself. So that was sort of what I wanted to explore. And then I kind of went, okay, well, probably what I would need to do is put her in a situation where she meets people who are also marginal or are not welcome in, so, or have felt unwelcome or may feel unwelcome or out of place in some way, and see how she reacts to them and how far she is prepared to go towards telling the truth. And then the story sort of unfolded, really. You just sort of follow the logical connections and then characters start to emerge and tell their story on those lines. And because I'd got that word asylum really early on, which was from Ad Astra Per Aspera, I suspect probably. Yes, it is, isn't it? I thought this has to be this has to be about asylum seekers. So so that's where I went.
Beautifully timely as well.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
for sure.
I mean, that's just, yeah.
Yeah, sadly, but yeah.
Well, yes, true.
And all of these things, I think, are in the current. So I think it's probably no surprise maybe that Strange New Worlds had that story.
No.
Yeah, with a sympathetic character. And then, you know, all these things, because they're in the current, then they are going to become, you know, immediate and in your face. But yeah, it got published on election day. And I was kind of, you know, blimey. And I got a couple of emails from people saying, you know, I was really glad I had this book because, I was sitting there all day, but at least I had Strange New Worlds to read. Yeah. But there we go. We'll go no further.
Yeah.
Yeah.
For good or ill. Go as far as you like. I don't mind. Yeah. Your podcast.
I definitely made a few social media posts saying, you know, the best thing that happened on November 5th was the publication of this novel. You need to go read it, kind of thing.
Uh-huh. Yeah. We didn't even have Bonfire Night because they don't do Bonfire Night on the 5th. They do it the weekend. So I couldn't even go look at some fireworks and, you know, enjoy things getting blown up. So.
Yeah, I was talking with former Infinite Diversity host Justin Ozer about this book, which he also loved it. And he was saying when he first started reading it, he's like, "Oh, it's great to have this book. It takes my mind off all the political climate right now." And then, like, once I started reading, I messaged him, "Okay, how exactly does this book take your mind off the political climate right now?" He's like, "Well, I hadn't gotten that far yet."
There was just some wisecracks and cats. It was great. Oh, no. Political wisecracks and political cats. Yeah. But no Garrick. Yeah.
Sadly. Yeah, there was a Garrick book this year, but you didn't write it.
I know. I'm kicking myself about that book because I looked at that premise and I thought, why did I never pitch this? No, I loved that. It was a wonderful book. Really, really enjoyed it. Yeah.
I think definitely, like has been said, a book of our time, like both in the UK and in the US, the things that are happening there for sure. There's a lot in the Una story in the Academy, though, that also really spoke to me. I loved the whole through line of a very high performing student, a gifted student who's facing that prospect of failure or underperformance for the first time. That felt very real, and like the kind of panic that sets in as things slip further and further back, and the splashes of cold water that Pelia has to keep kind of throwing in her face was really good.
Yeah. So I taught for a long time at Cambridge University, and I was an undergraduate here as well. And I think there's a lot of students that come to a university like that, which, you know, is globally well known. It's very high performing, high pressure environment. It's often people's first experience of meeting people who are smarter than them. So they're maybe 18 or 19, or maybe, you know, even graduate students, 20s. And it's their first time of not necessarily keeping on top of things and watching, just as you're saying, watching things slip away. I thought that's a really interesting thing to give to Una. And also then it became a story about Pike thinking, actually, you know, if they're on board a ship and they're cadets and this is the first time they're dealing with failure, that's a really bad idea. Yeah. Because that's life and death. And we put so much pressure on them as academy students to get into the academy, to be superb and then to perform superbly. And sometimes, doesn't Picard have a line about this? You know, sometimes you do your best and it's still not good enough. You know, that's just how life is. Yes. And to build that into the curriculum Pike, he's not in a great place either. No. Let's teach them about failure. He's going, yeah, that's right. my teaching philosophy there. So I think that it becomes a book about dealing with the reality that you, even if you do everything perfectly and by the regs, you might not, it might not work. And you need to learn that sooner mm-hmm. than later. Yeah. So that's kind of, that was where my train of thought went, I think. Yeah. And then we get to the Kobayashi Maru, don't we?
I did love that. It was kind of seeing this slow burn over the course of the novel. And I was like, I think I know where they're going with this. That was excellent. That was wonderful. Good. Little reveal there.
Good. I'm glad about that. Because that was exact slow burn was happening in my head. So I was kind of writing this plot line and I thought, you know, it's very close to the Kobayashi Maru, isn't it? And then I was going, well, when do we first see that on screen? So we know that Kirk's done it. Okay, but Kirk's a little bit younger. So I emailed Dayton and Dave Mack and I said, you know, because they know everything. Yeah, Dayton absolutely knows everything. Yeah, and, you know, Dayton knows everything. Dave can confirm it. Yeah. And I said, you know, do we ever see this on screen? Or and if we don't see it on screen, do we ever see it in a book? And they went, I don't think this has been covered. So you've got free reign with that one. I guess really, really. Like, this makes up for not doing that Garrett book that you did. So, but yeah, it was one of those things where you go, oh, this is a brilliant idea. So surely somebody's done the, you know, the Kobayashi Maru being created and the reason for it. And they hadn't, it transpired. Or if Dayton hasn't remembered it, then it hasn't happened.
Yeah, no, that was excellent. I really appreciated that for sure.
Good.
I love also the kind of inference that if the crew found out the hand that Pike had in creating that, there'd be a mutiny.
Yeah, yes. Yeah, yeah. Really furious. Particularly as he didn't have to do it. So, you know, it's like, what? And of course it would be the product of a mind as twisted as Pelia's. Yeah, it would be.
Oh, God, yes.
Yeah.
That's perfect.
Egged on by Pike. You know, Pike sort of sees this noble idea behind it. And Pelia's got, yes, can make my reputation. So I had a lot of fun with that. That was really good fun.
So let's talk a little bit about Pelia then, because I loved seeing her in this novel and the kind of relationship she has with Una and with Pike, which we saw a hint of in Strange New Worlds, where they had that friction between them. Was that kind of, as soon as you had the idea to do Una, you're like, oh, I've got to get Pelia in there at the Academy?
Absolutely. Yeah. That was a sort of, right, I've got this thing to go with, so let's just build from that and see how far it goes. And I loved the idea that Pelia is sort of, I think you get this feeling with Pelia, don't you, that you kind of, she kind of rocks up in any scene and, you know, this person is bonkers. Yeah. Why is this person on this uh-huh. ship? Yeah. And then you go, oh, right, I see why. Yeah. Okay. There's something going on here. And I think we've all been taught by people like this. I was taught mm-hmm. by someone like this, where you kind of go, this person really shouldn't be allowed to form young minds. And then you kind of, about 4 years later, you go, particularly if you start teaching yourself, this is exactly the kind of person that should be forming young minds. Yeah. So exactly that. So I imagine that a lot of the cadets, because, you know, could be quite pious. Yeah. You know, oh, we're not getting our, you know, we're not getting our fees worth from failure or whatever. Yeah. but actually what they're getting is something, or they think it's chaotic. And I think one of them doesn't see it. I think, is it Pike said he thought there was, as a cadet, he thought there was the whiff of a charlatan about her. But then when on the other side, he sees how much of it is considered and thought through, and that a lot of the spontaneity is actually quite, yeah, considered, exactly that. It's deployed carefully. So she just seemed ideal, I thought, to put into this kind of regulated situation and blow it up in their faces. Particularly third years, mm-hmm. I think, you know, they're sort of, you've kind of licked them into shape, but now you want them thinking a little bit more out of the box. So she just said, and it's one of those characters that you just wind them up and then, you know, they start doing their thing and all the stuff comes out. And it's somebody who just, it's great for writing. It just fills a page, but also it's just really good fun to read as well, I hope. Just a gift. Yeah.
Oh no, it's a ton of fun to read. Also, mm-hmm. if for some reason you're listening to this and you haven't read the book yet, which I'm very curious why, I do encourage you to check out the audiobook because Robert Petcoff does an amazing Carol Kane impression.
Oh
wow.
Nice.
Incredible. He really gets the cackle. Yeah. Mm-hmm. he gets everything. And I never know who I'm going to get. They're both great. We've got Robert Petcoff and January Lavoie. Mm-hmm. And I was sure it was going to be January. I thought surely it's going to be because there's so many female points of views. But no, it was Robert Petcoff, and he's also amazing. His Carol Kane is just, like you say, that it's just incredible.
Yeah.
Really, really good. He also does the British accents absolutely brilliantly, which is, yeah. And he says the name Una very Britishly, because American accent, British accent don't quite say it the same, but he just... it's perfect. Not that I was paying extra attention, but he absolutely got it. So yeah, he's great. So presumably he enjoys Pelia as much as we do.
Yeah, I think so.
Well, that's a good point to kind of talk a bit about Christopher Pike. We've kind of talked a little bit about him broadly here, but at this point he's got a really interesting perspective that I loved in this book, because he recently left the academy. He's been an ensign for a little bit. And so he's basically a lower decker, and he's gone through some pretty traumatic experiences. And now he's bringing that back to the academy. Mm-hmm. Maybe not directly because it's so fresh. He's still awaiting this hearing and all of this stuff, but it's really informing a lot of what he has to teach the students broadly at the academy, and specifically Una. What was it like writing Christopher Pike at this point? And boy, is that guy's life just like tragedy, from tragedy to tragedy, right?
I know. It's a bit like that. Yeah. So Pike's a really, really interesting character to write, I think, because on the surface, he looks like this lantern-jawed, you know, he looks like he's going to be a sort of he looks like a kind of Kirk figure, doesn't he? But then I think the way they've played it in Disco and then Strange New World is that you've got this it's almost like the old American hero. Yeah. But then they've given him this sort of storyline of this sense of his own mortality and this sense of almost melancholy about him, because he knows where, you know, he knows where his journey's going. And so this always feels very Pike-ish to me, yeah. There's something just a little. It's not brooding, and it's not quite that. But there's just something a little melancholic to it. And he's not necessarily sad or depressed or anything like that. But it's just this sense of being mortal about him. And so I thought it would be. I needed him at the academy. So there's various things you have to do as a writer. When you're kind of setting up a premise. Okay, I need him at the academy. But they don't quite overlap. You can fudge the dates a bit. It didn't seem as interesting to have them overlapping as students. Mm. It seemed more interesting to have, yeah, a kind of different, he's just a little bit out of it. So he's got a little bit to bring back. But then I couldn't think of a reason for, you know, a kind of high flyer like that to come and teach at the academy for 6 months. It's not the kind of career break that people take. Okay. So I thought, okay, well, let's kind of weave something in. He's not back there by choice. So he's probably got injured in some way. So he's a bit down about that. And then to kind of build up the context, I think as I was starting to have that theme of living with failure or dealing with situations where you can't win, that started to sort of give me the idea of what that situation would be. And it's just that he's been in a situation where his commanders weren't equipped to deal with something going badly wrong, and somebody dies, and, you know, he's waiting, he gets injured, he's waiting for an inquiry to happen. So they said, well, go to the academy and, you know, rest up and do a bit of instructing, and you know, go and have a couple of drinks with Pelia and just get your head sorted, yeah, and your leg sorted, because he's damaged his leg. So that was sort of, you're kind of bringing together little threads of different storylines and themes. But it seems to me that even quite a young Pike, although he's ambitious and takes risks and has a lot of humour and joy and personal warmth about him, there's always this little thread of melancholy going through him that feels very Pike-ish to me. So I wanted a tiny little note of that. And this is what I kind of cooked up. So he's not Kirk, yeah? He's Pike, yeah? They're not the same people, yeah? Yeah. Kirk rocks up on Pike's ship and starts measuring for curtains, yeah? Pike wouldn't do that. Not Pike's ambitious, but he's not brash, yeah.
I really appreciated that story, and especially the frankness of it that comes later, where he's talking about the captain and first officer and how they just weren't ready for what faced them, and they completely came apart in that moment. And
yeah, and he doesn't want that because he's ambitious. He's going, well, one day I intend to be that captain. So who's going to be my number one? Mm-hmm. And then Una Chin Reilly walks into his life. So, mm-hmm. And Pike, because he's ambitious, will be thinking of these kinds of things. You know, if you meet these, if you teach at this kind of university, you meet people who have got very clear career goals of where they want to be by 25, 30, 35. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I want to be retired by 40, these kinds of things. This is where I want to be hitting at 45. Yeah. Or this is where I want to be at 35. And Pike's like that. And I imagine it would be standard in the academy. You know, I want to be first officer on this ship by the time I'm this age. And Pike's gone captain and captain of the flagship. And at this point, he's going, and this is the kind of people I'll need around me as my crew. And number one is number one, yeah. The first, yeah. So that's all going in my head as well, yeah.
So for this next bit, I guess we'll kind of jump a little bit. This topic's going to kind of straddle the two time periods, I guess. So we've got the present day setting, season two of Strange New Worlds, like you said, shortly after Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow. So we're fairly fresh off of Una's hearing in Ad Astra Per Aspera, and a lot of those issues, of course, coming to the forefront with the main thrust of the story, which we haven't even really talked about yet, the Chionians and the Yuxana, this kind of cultural minority group of this feline species. Which I loved your description of them, by the way, and kind of how they acted. I really enjoyed that.
Love a cat, yeah.
I was wondering
love
if there
alien
were...
cats, yeah.
Yeah. I was wondering if there were real life felines that inspired these characters.
So not specific characters, just observations of cats, for one thing. So I have talked about this a lot, but I really love Fonda McIntyre's books. And there's a lot of alien cats in those, a lot of alien cat species. And then we've got the alien cats in Lower Decks as well. So I thought, okay, I'm gonna have some alien cats. My kid is nuts about snow leopards. It's kind of you know, is sponsored snow leopards for the world while I fund and that kind of thing. So I said, okay, do you want a book with snow leopards in? And because, you know, it's my book and I'm boss. and my kid said, yeah, I'd love a book with some alien snow leopards in. So I thought, okay, I've got these lovely snow leopards now. I need a distinct, I think of them as two distinct species, actually, but I haven't pinned them down and done DNA tests. And then the other ones, I thought, I want something that looks physically different. I mean, oh, it's still a cat, an alien cat walking around. I was kind of flipping through various wildcats and I looked at servals, yeah. And they're kind of more golden furred and have these very long, they're very, very elegant. Whereas snow leopards are quite stocky and have these big, my kid calls them murder mittens. They've got these big paws, yeah. murder bits. Right, we nicked that off a snow leopard site. So the kind of bad cats are servals who are a little bit, and that has all kind of wordplay in my head, like Serpentine, and the villain in Blake Seven is called Servalan, and these kinds of things. So in my head, it's kind of. It's completely kind of slandering these poor cats, which are perfectly charming wild cats. But they're kind of, so I didn't have specific cats in mind, because I don't live with cats, but I have observed cats in action. I hope they feel feline. I hope they feel feline, but you know, their own thing. So that's sort of where they came from. And it's fun in a book because you can just sort of, you can go, well, they're a bit like a cat, but obviously they're their own thing. Yeah. So who knows precisely what they would look like if we had unlimited budgets. This sort of thing. That's the nice thing about books, isn't it? So yeah, I thought cats would be fun. And then I kind of turned to, you know, the most demanding audience nearby and followed direction and then sort of extrapolated from that. I think they're different species. But they're certainly distinct enough that when Una meets them later, she doesn't realize that she's dealing with the same species that she met a long time ago, because there's lots of different reasons for that kind of, you know, they're using a different language, they're using different words, they are physically quite dissimilar, so she doesn't quite twig straight away, I think. So those are the Yuxana. I see Kyonians, but I'm not quite sure. I think they're Kyonians.
I will defer to the expert for sure.
This is a whole other thing about the names in this book. I had to record a file of these, so they're quite X heavy.
Yeah, there's definitely, I had to kind of, again, we're very similar, making notes as I'm reading, because like, okay, which one? Nuxana. Okay, that's okay. And yeah, so.
Yeah. I think Paul, so they were recording the audiobook. Usually they send me a list of words and I just kind of phonetically describe it. And this one, I got down to about 3 or 4 and I emailed back and said, you know what? I'm just going to record me saying these things. Because I think that'll cut out a lot of this confusion. I think I've got that far. I said this somewhere else. I think I might pop that up on my website so that people can hear me doing it in my booth. My most precise Cambridge accent. Be absolutely clear on these.
I love the, I don't know if you intended this, but I got an Egyptian vibe from the Yuxana names. And maybe just because the first one you read is Anxa, and it sounds like Ankh, which then led me to Egypt and cats and, you know, how important they were. And then when you have Kyonian, it's very Greek. So like that combination and conflict, it really worked.
That's lovely. I hadn't actually thought of that, but that's exactly where I want, that's exactly the kind of thing I wanted you to be going to, is awesome. That the kind of two civilizations which are so close, that are distinct, but are so close that at various points they are, you know, the Egyptian culture becomes Hellenic, doesn't it? You know, exactly that. So yeah, they should be so closely woven that you don't necessarily, you can't always quite tell the difference. So I hadn't thought of that, but it's absolutely perfect. And you got what I wanted from it. Readers are brilliant.
Good deal.
Readers do the work for you.
Oh, that's really cool. Great insight. That's awesome.
Yeah, I really love that.
There's so much going on with the Kyonians and the Yuxana. I there's so much that I recognized. For one thing, my part of the world where I live, a lot of native population, First Nations, Métis, Inuit groups, and I'm Métis myself. I don't know what the exact percentage is, but my mom is Métis, my grandma's Métis, and you know, so I look fairly Caucasian, but you know, you hear, like, I distinctly remember on, like, hearing jokes on the playground that I just kind of had to laugh along with because for self-preservation. Mm-hmm. And so much of, especially the Linchar, the leader of the Kyonian diplomatic delegation, a lot of what she says, both, you know, out loud and to herself, just was sounded so true. Like the self-righteousness and being proud of herself for deigning to include a Yuksana on her team, but at the same time, like, oh, weird, I offered the other guy a drink, but I never offer, whatever. And just like, oh, you're so close. You're so close.
I know. Yes, she's a horrible racist.
Oh, God. Yeah. The worst kind.
Yeah. Anti-marvelous in my kind of the generosity that I show. I think by the end, that you're so close. I think at the end, she's inched a little further. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. She's not a stupid woman. She's a very I think when life treats you kindly, or the situation in which you are born just completely advantages you, it can be hard to sort of go, well, maybe this doesn't actually work, you know, because it manifestly has for you. So to give her due, I think there's a little, I think there is a little inch towards self-awareness towards the end. It's you've got to be careful writing this, because you don't just want to write her as a kind of, you know, it'd be very easy to write her as just a stupid, nasty person. But she isn't stupid, and she isn't actually nasty. She's just, she's racist. She's chauvinist. Mm-hmm. She's prejudiced. She looks at the world through a particular lens, and it isn't a true one. It's one that she is so prismatic that it's always justifying her beliefs. She can't look for evidence against it. So you try and write that quite carefully. And even I think when she's dealing with the Federation, she's got a sneaking feeling that, well, half of us going, oh, and we are obviously the best that there is. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. But then part of her is looking at particularly the Vulcan ambassador and going, maybe. And then she can't quite take herself a little bit further. I think she's scared by that Vulcan. She's even more scared by the humans.
Chaotic.
On that note, I found it interesting that you deliberately chose to have the Kyonians use the word cultivated to describe what they consider to be enlightened, civilized people. What brought you to use that instead of like civilized, which is what you would generally think you would use if we were talking about racist humans, for instance?
Yeah, I think that would have been too on the nose, wouldn't it? That would have been too on the nose. So I did look for something that was a little bit more something that wouldn't be so kind of like, oh, if you've not got it yet, then you
gotcha.
And cultivated maybe implies it implies something. If we think of the Yuksana as being you know, the by preference the nomadic, so if you're nomadic, you don't to the same extent cultivate. You won't be gardening or making parks or putting lawns down. So I suppose there's a field of other meanings behind a word like that, that you try and connect up, to the cultures that you're sort of describing. But cultivated just seemed like something. I think I was typing civilized and going, yeah. And then cultivated popped. And I thought that was, And also it implies a sort of, It's a project of self-advancement, yeah? I think Lin Char is proud not just of her culture and her ancestry. She's proud of her own efforts in making herself well-read, knowledgeable. You know, she probably plays several instruments or, you know, these sorts of things, or speaks several. It's a process of self-improvement as well, which she sort of looks at her Yuxana sidekick and goes, oh yeah, he's made an effort at self-cultivation and this sort of thing. And so I think it implies a lot more of self civilization as well, that perhaps cultivation carries that a bit more than civilization perhaps. So that would probably be another reason why I chose it. I genuinely do, honestly, not every word in a book, but a word like that, I genuinely do sort of fret about it till I get it right. So I'm glad that one's come up. You want something that's conveying something similar to what a human might use in a situation like that, but it has to have other nuances, I think. So cultivation was where I want nuance. That's another word they use, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah.
I thought that was great. I definitely got the agricultural versus hunter gatherer nomadic vibe from that. And the fact that, you know, they're talking about building something up as opposed to just taking what is naturally given, you know, and all of that. And that just, there's all those other layers of that that you can, because I tend to look at it from a historical perspective, I can see that from all of those, you know, the beginnings of civilization and different ways of defining it and all of that. And that was, yeah, cultivate made me think agriculture right away. And that's perfect.
Yeah. And they have, I think, as I recall, she talks about her lands and their properties and their, yeah, so there's an investment in a kind of, that some of identity is bound up in the ownership of land, in a way that the Yuxana don't necessarily, you know, there's land and we inhabit it, or we move around it, or we make use of it in different ways. We don't sort of contain and enclose and preserve. So I think some of those things are going on. And that's fine. Yeah, you want to do that. Just don't do it on our bits of land. Yeah. or these bits of land over here, which are the ones that we habitually use. So that's all going on as well, I think. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, good. I'm glad that's sort of coming through. You try not to make it too much of a dichotomy, but at the same time, they do have this sort of worldview which isn't necessarily compatible. But one of them is sort of more aggressively policed, I think.
Well, speaking of language, there's one bit that I absolutely loved in this, and the timing of it for other stuff was interesting. There's the insistence by the Kyonians that Yuxana is not a language, it's just a dialect. And, you know, all of this stuff. I was recently listening to one of my favorite podcasts, which is The Illusionist by Helen Zaltzman. And she was talking a very similar issue about languages in Singapore and a language that the Singaporean government has at various times been trying to eliminate, this Singlish, which is kind of described as a patois between, you know, English and Singaporean. And the government would say that, yeah, it's just a Creole, a you know, whatever. But like, there's been dictionaries and books and stuff written in this language that is spoken and treated as a language by the people there. I just, the timing of that was so fascinating, that here's this real life example I was listening to at the same time I was reading this novel, and I was like, oh my God.
Well, it's everywhere. You know, you can find that in Britain as well. People get very angry if you talk about, or some, a certain subset of people get very angry if people talk about Scots being a distinct language in its own right. They get really, really wound up about that. I give Uhura my sort of opinions about this, is that, you know, there's no hierarchy in this. It's about the hierarchy is always going to be something that we impose, because if people are communicating with it and communicating successfully, it's doing its job. Yeah, it's a language. Yeah. That's that, you know, and to get obsessed about the genealogy of it, or the ancestry, or the paternity, it's a really weird thing.
Yeah.
And it's a really weird thing to do. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's just so obvious, the bias, that, you know, why would you want to say, oh, this isn't a language? It's to have power over the people who are speaking it or whatever, right? So
yeah, yeah, Exactly. It's a really weird, really weird thing. I said, it's a mindset I sort of can't get into.
It's all made up anyway.
Exactly. I know. Maybe it's to do with when you say, maybe, you know, if you communicate, if you do things like podcasts or you write, you're so conscious that what you're doing is making stuff up as you're going along. Yeah.
Totally.
You have a much greater sense of its ephemerality and it's the way it's created in the moment and these sorts of things. At the same time, I'm learning Irish at the moment because of lots of complicated reasons, but the time is right to learn Irish, which is a language that, you know, has been policed and punished and all these sorts of things and is nearly died out and is having this sort of brilliant resurgence at the moment. And at the same time as we say languages they're just a thing, that there's a reality of them being politicized, yeah. Mm-hmm. And you've got to push back against that as well, I think. So this is one of my favorite things to explore, I think, probably because I had been learning Irish. One of the things I say a lot, I've joked about, is that if you want to learn Irish, absolutely the worst language to be learning it from is English. They really, really don't have very much in common. They have quite a lot in common, and they really have a great deal not in common. And it's been tremendously interesting to discover this about a language which is, you know, spoken by my ancestors and is spoken in an island not very far away from where I live, and to sort of confront my own ignorance about it and the pleasure of discovering, you know, the intricacy of it, the beauty of it has been really satisfying. There's quite a lot of that went into the relationship between those languages. I think the scene that Spock and Uhura and Ortegas have about autonomous verbs is directly lifted from studying Irish, and it's one of my favorite scenes in the book, actually. I love that little scene. So lots going on.
Mm-hmm. I love how into it you get with the you know, the lack of the passive voice and all of that stuff. That was language nerds are like, yay, this is so cool.
And that's totally there in Irish. It doesn't have a passive. Events take place. So they have a passive that goes, oh yeah, an event took place. Yeah. Not you know, a thing was done by X. It was more breakages occurred. Yeah, which I really love it. And then you can form a sentence that kind of, you know, makes clear who did the breaking. But I love the sort of I love the sort of nuances of what that, how different that is, how you would have to do that in English. It has all these different kind of nuances. We're back to that was a little autonomous verbs. When I discovered them, it was like, the deniability on offer to me now is incredible. Wonderful. Where has this been in my life?
Awesome. Well, I really enjoyed the linking of the past and the present with through the Yuksana that we meet. So there's this family in Una's academy days that her friend Teresa Mullins is working with as asylum seekers, as refugees kind of thing. And Una gets involved with them, gets to meet a few of them. And like you said, doesn't make the connection initially in the present day that this is, you know, related species, if not the same species kind of thing, other than through this Yuksana aid that she recognizes and realizes and makes that kind of what she sees as the diplomatic faux pas of speaking in this language that he's tried so hard to kind of distance himself from and stuff. I loved trying to figure out, you know, oh, there's somebody who's doing some pretty horrible things. First of all, there's it's just some light protest, right? Like with the spray painted slogans and stuff. And then of course there's the bomb threat, which is a very different beast later. I had a lot of fun trying to figure out, is like, okay, I think it's somebody from this group. It must be Naxana, right? She seemed like she was getting radicalized. And then pull out a really good kind of whodunit here that surprised me at every turn, honestly.
Well, I am really pleased about that because a couple of people have said to me now, I thought it was going to be Naxana. And that hadn't even crossed my mind.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. It's really good. Because I was telling this story going, oh, God, this is really tricky because I've basically only got three people. Yeah. I've only really created three of these aliens that you know. And then the lawyer figure appears and you go, is it him? And I hadn't even thought, I knew that Naxandra had gone down that route. But I was thinking, oh, people are going to guess this miles off. So you've all invented extra suspects, which is marvelous. You've really done my work for me. It was absolutely great. So I hadn't thought of that, but a couple of people have said now, oh, I thought this is where Naxana was going to come back, but no, it was Hax. Hax came back instead. Yeah. So I'm really pleased about that because I was worried when you set up a whodunit, you're always trying to have enough people because you must have watched episodes of stuff where you've gone, well, look, there really is only two people that this can be, and it's not that one. You signposted it too often or whatever, you know. So I was worried I didn't have enough people. So I'm really glad about that. So that's a relief.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I really loved where their characters ended up too, both Hax mm-hmm. and Naxana. Like that was very heartwarming for me that they were, you know, working hard for the Uxana, but not in the way that we had feared as reading this. That was so lovely to hear him talk about how, you know, he and his sister differ on a lot of things and I rate her in sometimes, but
yeah,
that was really great.
Good. I'm glad. I think he says she's protected to some degree by Federation citizenship, but it, you know, if there's a sit in and a piece of direct action, I imagine she's right in the thick of it. And that's not the kind of thing he does. He, you know, is working behind the scenes. And I imagine when they meet for family dinners, you know, the pair of them are at it like this. Yeah. And then the two younger brothers kind of just swan up and, you know, but families are like that. They find, you know, the truth is that they want this same thing, which is for their cause to be recognized and the people to be free. But the route that they've chosen is very different and very, and you know, and because of the different ages when these events happen to them, their different experiences and their different personalities. But they would help each other out like that if it was needed. I think there'll be lots of communication between those two. But yeah, good. I'm glad that felt real. I should have brought Naxana back.
Next book.
Yeah. With Garrick.
There you go. We don't know how long they live.
We don't. No, very true.
They could be 300, 400 years old. That works.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Garrick can give them all sorts of pointers.
Oh, God. God, I hope not. Maybe Kira is the one they need to be talking to. Maybe they talk to Kira.
Hax, you blew up your own investigative office? What's going on?
Who have you been talking to?
Oh, Garrick.
How? How did the ambassador die in a sudden explosion on board his ship?
Oh, no. Oh, it got so much darker. I love it.
Suddenly it stopped. It stopped being Strange New Worlds and become DS9, yeah.
So again, I gave a spoiler warning, but like, geez, if you haven't read this book and you're listening this far, I really question your life choices. So the architect.
It's
of
okay
this...
to not be worried about spoilers. We were, you know, we're up at the 30th anniversary of Generations, right? And we all knew that Kirk was going to die. Spoilers.
That's true. Wait, I haven't watched it.
Sorry.
It's fine. There's that weird Uncanny Valley fan video that just came out that shows that he's not really exactly dead. That.
Do you know, we joke about this, but there's a Doctor Who story from about 1965 that I had not seen until about 15 years ago when I watched all the Doctor Who from start to end, and I had no idea what happened in it. And then the day before we started watching it, I looked it up. I just looked it up on the internet, check something about an actor who was in it, and was immediately spoiled for something massive. So I mean, it's my own fault, but it really was that. Oh, if I just not well, you should get off your phones, shouldn't you? That serves me right. Well,
I'm sure there are some people who just don't necessarily have the time to read the book now, so they listen to podcasts like these to get the gist of it.
That's fair. And that's fine. Fair.
That's great. We could say it.
But you should still buy the book.
We could say anything, couldn't we? So you should deliberately, I've spent too much time with Garrett, you should deliberately have a section in each one of your literary ones that has a little lie about what's in the book. Oh, yeah, I love that Guinan scene was incredible. Whoa.
Everyone else is flipping through their book.
I was not expecting Q to resolve the issue.
Yeah, exactly that.
No. Here's one that people might actually believe. I love how you integrated Apple TV's For All Mankind into this show, into this book. That's all I could think about with the Aries thing. And I know that's that wasn't yours to start with, but...
I
pictured, like, I could see... the people stuck on the station For All Mankind, like, okay, we're bored. Let's do a Gilbert and Sullivan play as opposed to redoing Bob Newhart over and over again.
Yeah, I know. Hey, Bob. And that
same universe now.
And it is, well, yeah, you know, Ron Moore, of course. That was one of Dayton's deep cuts. True. Is that it was part of the Kobayashi Maru discussion, and I said, Pelia's running this class and they're doing things like running through the Apollo 13 mission. And he said, you've got to get Ares 4 from that episode. And Dave Mack and I went, what? Wow. Well, you know, we are not worthy. So he we were really impressed with that. And yeah, we have to do that. But you're right. It's very For All Mankind, isn't it?
Yeah.
So I love them putting on the, you know, the Mikado, putting on the hazmat stuff.
That's awesome that part of the novel too, because I right when you said like, oh, famous space disasters, my brain immediately went, oh, Apollo 13, wouldn't that be cool? And then sure enough it gets mentioned, and then Ares 4, and I was like, okay, yeah, no, that's brilliant.
Well, that's Dayton.
Yeah, well, it follows that Trek pattern, right? Like, you have the list where you have, you know, two real world ones and then the crazy science fiction one.
Exactly.
Like, Napoleon, Hitler, and Malthus. It was great.
All the great historical novelists, you know, Tolstoy, Mantel, McCormack.
Give it a few hundred years, then you'll be historical.
Give it a few, exactly that.
Awesome.
Yeah, that was all really good fun. Yeah.
We could talk a little bit about how the main everything resolves with the aide who I honestly hadn't really paid much attention to the whole story. You did a really good job of hiding him in plain sight, the architect of everything here. But that was an interesting character as well. The sympathizer, the person who kind of got radicalized by
the
horrible things he's seen.
And obviously he's the one who is going to stick a bomb somewhere, because to some extent he's going to be protected by, you know, all sorts of things. So he would take a risk like that probably not many Yuxana would take, because the consequences would be so violent. So he's a sort of, give him his due, you know, he puts himself where he's, he puts himself out for this cause, and he's right to. And in a way, that felt quite truthful, that somebody who has been privileged to have been brought up and think, oh, you know, I live in a great place and we're doing really well, and, you know, there's been trouble in the past, but we're working through it, to sort of realise that has been a lie, and a lie told to you by family, by relatives, by schools, by social structures, It is going to radicalize you in that way. It's not like growing up with the, you know, to, it's worse to grow up with the, to be the victim of this, but it's not a surprise. It's not going to quake the world in that way. And his world was quaked. His world was shaken by something. I think he saw some brutality in the streets, and it shocked him, because I think he's quite personable and, you know, pleasant and cultivated. Yeah, and then to see this done by, oh, I always thought they were the violent ones. No, I can't square that with the evidence of my own eyes. There's a lot to be said for him, I think. He's an interesting character.
This is probably really obvious, but like it rings really true that like the distance traveled in your worldview is directly proportional to how far you're willing to go, you know, to challenge that, right? Like the Yuksana who've grown up, who've lived in this, they know. They're like, yeah, we know. And in some ways, they're almost used to it, or they're like the frog in the boiling pot of water, right? Like,
yeah.
But this was such a shock to him.
The choking feeling will always be there, won't it? That feeling of that horrible feeling of it not being right and it being unjust. But for him, it's kind of like, this wasn't true. None of this was true. That was true.
Yeah, such a violent realization almost follows Newton's law, where it needs an equal and opposite reaction.
Yeah, that's very insightful. Yeah. No, I would agree with that. And as I say, the consequences will probably not be as bad for him.
No.
That
goes along with the academy theme too, with the you know, being exposed to new ideas in college and. You know, changing your mind about things because you're leaving a place that you'd lived your whole life. And
yeah,
well, that gets into politics about, you know, the United States too. So, no.
Yeah, very easily, alas. But many places. But yeah, I wonder what it is that Marichat, maybe he saw something on the street. Or he might have gone along to, you know, I can imagine him and some friends going, oh, I know, I've heard there's this Yuksana comedian. Let's go and listen to that set. So that'd be a bit of an edgy thing to do, won't it? And we're quite right on and this sort of thing. And then they go and watch this really angry political comedian, and they're like, okay, that wasn't what, you know. And certainly a couple of his mates like maybe are a bit, you know, but one of them goes away and thinks about it, and the others go, well, that was stupid, or, you know, it's nothing like that. But one of them, it just makes him think in some way. Because Falxo, the uncle in the Academy story, he's meant to be a stand-up comedian. So that's what he's done. He's cracked jokes, and that's why he's in so much trouble. I'm not sure how much that came through, but that was what I thought in my head.
No. I did not I didn't pick comedian. Up on that.
I got satirist, maybe.
Yeah.
But, like, not professionally, you know.
Yeah, I think he probably, you know, some of it is satire and some of it is cartoons and some of it is standing up and cracking jokes. That's so you're meant to think, maybe as a reader, oh God, he's clearly been planting bombs here, there and everywhere. This other. No, he's just
verbal.
It's just been jokes. Yeah.
No.
And that's the frightening bit, isn't it? Laughing at them.
Yeah. Is that what I laughed out loud when I read Tom Lehrer. Is that what brought you to Tom Lehrer? The, you know, political comedy and all of that? Because that's just beautiful.
Oh, Tom Lehrer was a gift. Well, that's because of the Gilbert and Sullivan stuff, isn't it? I mean, Lehrer I knew anyway. He does the periodic table to...
Right, with the Gilbert and Sullivan, Yeah, but it's so funny because I know him from my mother introducing me to him as a political comedian, a commentator, you know.
Right.
Not quite on the line of Falxo, what you're talking about, but so it didn't even, that connection didn't even click for me until later, because like the periodic table song is not one that I heard much. It was always like, you know, the songs about the Catholic Church and things like that. I didn't even make that connection.
Right, but, I see. Yep, or the one about we'll all go together when we go. That's that and periodic table probably landed at the same time with me. And then so coincidentally, my kid really got into Gilbert and Sullivan last year.
Nice.
And we've been and watched a lot of them and listened to a lot of them. And there are bits where you we watched Pirates of Penzance this summer, a really good production, all male production came round, very young performers, about half of them got like their first professional job. And I didn't know Penzance very well. And it's really stupid. Yeah. And it's just an amazing, it's just so stupid in an amazing way. And then at the end, it's so stupid about how it resolves that, you know, the pirates will not hear a word said against the queen, basically. And that is so bang on for, you know, there are moments when you read British papers and people go, you can't say that about the royal family. And I go, yeah, you really can say that about the royal family. And Gilbert and Sullivan are just parodying it. You know, the pirates go, we couldn't possibly not kneel before the queen, you know. And it's so they're more satirical than perhaps you suspect, I think, in quite a safe way. Mm-hmm. But but Lehrer is a lot. Yeah, that's really interesting that he was a political, yeah, rather than a wordsmith. But mm-hmm. I suspect we get him a bit differently in Britain.
That might be.
Yeah.
The first thing I think of with Lair is actually poisoning pigeons in the park.
Pigeons in the park.
Yes. yeah.
That's the other one, isn't it? Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
There's a singing duo in Britain called Flanders and Swan who do similar kind of, I think of it as that kind of high level college cabaret. Yeah. And it's something very mm-hmm. similar, but lots of wordplay, lots of jokes. And a show, a stage show, and a pianist, but they're not political in the same way. So I wonder if a lot of Lehrer's stuff gets bracketed with them in the UK. But I suspect it's Periodic Table I got first. And Daniel Radcliffe can do it, can't he? he performed it on a chat show. Yeah.
Love it.
He doesn't quite pull it off, and the audience start clapping along, and he's going, "Shut up! I'm trying to concentrate." Hard. Bless him.
Well, is there anything else that we haven't brought up that you would like to talk about with regards to the novel?
I think we got everything. We did. We've done Gilbert and Sullivan. We've done autonomous verbs. We've done how stupid the pronunciations are, and we've poisoned. Poisoned Stupid. Pigeons in the park.
I did want to touch on the Kyonians and the Yuxana for a second again. Mm. You mentioned how you see them as different species. Does that mean the Kyonians do not have dew claws at all? Or do they all remove them like they make the Yuxana do?
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. Oh, no, I'm not sure now. God, what a good question. I thought they had them and trimmed them. But okay. now you say that would be quite reasonable, wouldn't it? Yeah, that's not how people are meant to be or look. Yeah, I don't mm-hmm. know. I shall have to allow people to resolve that one for themselves. That's a really interesting, observation. I don't know if I can't remember now whether I explicitly say something in the book, but certainly so. Either by culture or either by sort of. Social pressure or whatever, the Yuxana are expected not to have this. How interesting.
Yeah. I picked
just
up on that too.
Now, yeah. You know, yeah. I'll just flip through the book and check whether I said anything. Yeah.
It makes me think, assuming the Kyonians don't have them and the Yuxana do, it makes me think this is quite to the same extreme as removing a piece of your body. But it makes me think of what's very, unfortunately, very common is the suppression of natural black hairstyles.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Yeah.
And forcing people to straighten their hair, that sort of thing.
And that fits perfectly with Hack's not only keeping the claws, but painting them and making them more visible.
Yeah.
Love it. Yeah.
Yeah. I loved his nail varnish. Yeah.
Now I'm imagining like a deep dive into Kyonian culture where, you know, a dew claw is something like, I don't know, wisdom teeth or something, like, except like every once in a while someone's born with a dew claw and it's like a huge thing. And the parents take them quietly to the doctor and Because you don't want to be like those ugly Masana, right?
Oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah. That's really interesting.
Ooh, that's a whole other.
Anyway. Yeah, see, fanfictionness is there. So, you know, like, AO3 is there. So.
Absolutely.
I was not reading them as different species. And that makes more sense now, because if they're actually different species, they can't interbreed. And so that makes a huge difference in terms of how they're going to perceive each other, which is so funny because Thad and I are going from here to talk about the episode of Lower Decks from this week about the cubes and the spheres, where that's a plot point.
But, yeah.
You know, I was surprised that we never came across a hybrid of the group. And so that's a whole other level. And so to know that you intended that they weren't the same species, that makes sense.
And hybridity, I think I've covered that a lot in other Starship novels. And obviously Deep Space Nine really goes into that, Voyager as well. Perhaps not scientifically convincingly, but let's not worry about that kind of Bajorans and Cardassians. Though arguably, I think we're meant to think there's a backstory of Bajorans and Cardassians, aren't we? Had something to do with the Hibetians. I don't know. I always kind of sense that, but never quite gets to the bottom of it. It didn't even cross. That's really interesting, because if somebody observes something about something you've written and you say, oh, there wasn't a hybrid character, that lends credence to my sense that they are different species, because you tend to imagine things, but not consciously. Sort of, you know, state them to yourself, but I think they're quite distinct, and it hopefully explains why Una doesn't immediately recognize that these are the same inhabitants of the same planet.
Well, speaking for myself, absolutely love the novel. I think definitely worth picking up. Very, very prescient, and just even beyond that, just a really great examination of some characters that I love. So top marks for sure.
Thank you. And I think particularly when you've written an outline and then somebody comes back and says, do you know what, we're gonna have to unpick this, and you're always, when you're writing, going, oh, this wasn't the book I was intending to tell. So you don't know that, so it's really good that you don't feel that either. So that makes it all worthwhile, that my sitting there going, oh, I'm not happy with this, it's not what you're experiencing.
Definitely not. Yeah.
Not at all.
For sure.
Good.
No, it's wonderful.
Yeah. We'll have to have you back sometime in season 3, and we can talk about what was.
That'd be really interesting, because obviously very zipped at the moment.
Of course. Absolutely.
Yeah. But definitely.
Well, one thing I hope you're not zipped about is maybe anything you're working on that our listeners and viewers would be interested in checking out.
Let's see. So probably I am a bit zipped up about those, but there's some Big Finish stuff that's been announced. I don't know if people like Doctor Who or listen to Doctor Who, Big Finish have just announced a series called Call Me Master, and it's with Sacha Darwin, so the Jodie Whittaker Master. Nice. I've got an audio play with one of those, which was really good fun. And that's my play's a little bit like, if you know Mervyn Peake, he did as well as the Gorman Gas books, he did a book called Mr. Pie, which is about a man who's so good that he starts to sprout angel wings. Really, it's set on Sark, which is one of the tiniest of the Channel Islands. So if people like that kind of thing, they might enjoy that book. And that was really great. I pitched it to Matt Fitton, who's the editor of The Range, and I said I want to do the Master, but in Mr. Pie. And Matt said, that's my favorite book. Yes. Sometimes you just make the right pitch. So that's just been announced. They're coming out next year. But everything else, I think I'm zipped on. I've got a non-fiction book coming out, but that's only in the UK. And that was something that was something fun and new. So there's a radio program in Britain called Woman's Hour that's been running for 70 years. Yeah. And it's a kind of, you know, it started out as a kind of women's issue program. They had guests on like Eleanor Roosevelt right from the start. What we've done with this book is we've taken a quote from someone interesting or well-known or not necessarily famous, but has done something of interest. A quote for every day of the year, and then a kind of reflection on what that quote could mean. So it was really good fun. It turned out, because I was a historian, then a sociologist, all sorts of different things. It turns out I know a lot of things very superficially. As opposed to one thing really in depth. I've read something about that. So it's exactly the skill I need to employ. I've read something about that. Hang on. But that's coming out for Women's Day next year, so for March the 8th. So that was a really nice book to work on. A very different thing for me to do, and something closer to the kind of thing I used to do. Hope people like that one. But everything else, zip.
Fair enough. Fair enough, for sure.
That means there's things coming, so that's good.
Well, we hope so.
Good that way.
Awesome. And where can people find you online when you can announce such things?
Such things. So I am now on Blue Sky. I have fled Twitter. And it's very exciting on Blue Sky the past 2.5 weeks because I have, this is ridiculous. I had about 2,000 followers on November the 4th. I now have over 8,000. I've nearly reached it's nearly hit my Twitter count, which is extraordinary. My Twitter count has declined precipitously, but I've lost about 1,000 bots over the past year or so. But unbelievably, in 3 weeks, I've nearly equaled my sort of Twitter, which is absolutely crackers. So Blue Sky is where I am now. And it's just my name. It's at Una McCormack. And it's been a bit weird because I've kind of gone from, to saying things to Tumbleweed, to saying things and people are replying, which is a bit of a bit disconcerting, but that's nice too. So it feels like the place is open for business, which is a good feeling. And also quite nice business as opposed to, people just being horrible to each other. So it's got a good vibe if people are not there, and come and follow me there.
Absolutely. And so Chrissy, tell us a little bit about the Infinite Diversity podcast and where people can find you.
All right. Well, Thad and I are over on the BQN. Infinite Diversity is where we discuss each new episode of Trek as it comes out. Yeah, you definitely should be listening to that if you're enjoying this. I'm also on the BQN with History with the Zalagis, and that is it's supposed to be twice weekly, but things have been crazy. Short history podcast I do with my fellow historian husband, Jason. He has decided to take a deep dive into the German politics of the post-World War I, pre-World War II era. Take for that what you will. He's got some of those lined up, as do I for some other elements of that as well. And then I'm also mostly over on Blue Sky anymore. I haven't officially shut down my Twitter account, but I haven't logged into it in so long that it's as good as. And there you can see my opinions about Star Trek history and, leftist politics.
Excellent. And Thad, why don't you tell us a little bit about where we can find you on the internet as well?
Yeah, well, as Chrissy said, I'm on Infinite Diversity. You can also hear me on the podcast I do with my friend Carl called License to Spiel. That's license spelled with a C like the British do it, where we started out talking about James Bond, and now we're talking about other movies and TV shows. And like everyone else, I have moved from Twitter to Blue Sky. Yeah. I am at Tyrannicus. That's Tyrannicus.
Excellent. And you can find the podcast on Blue Sky at Positively Trek. Again, like Una, our listener or our readership, I guess, has quintupled over the last couple of weeks, which is amazing to see. I think we got included on one of those starter packs or something, which is very helpful. I'm also personally on Blue Sky at Kurtratz. We still have our Twitter, but I think that's going to be winding down in the short term here. Positively Trek remains on a sort of hiatus until January, where we're going to start up regular episodes again. But of course, the release of a new Star Trek novel is an occasion for which we will come back and do an episode, obviously. And I hope everybody checked out our last episode, the interview with Nana Visitor. That was a big thrill. I definitely, if you haven't checked that out, there's also a video version on YouTube. Kurtratz Productions is the YouTube channel you can find that at. So, yeah. Thank you all for listening. Thank you to my wonderful co-host this week and our honored guest, Una McCormack. Thank you so very much. And until next time, as always, stay positive. Positively Trek is produced and edited by me, Dan Gunther, and co-produced by Barry DeFord on Treaty 8 territory, the home of the Beaver, Cree, Dene, and Métis people, whose histories, languages, and cultures we respect. We acknowledge the many First Nations, Métis, and Inuit who have lived in and cared for these lands for generations.
Some things you wouldn't mind being stuck with, like a huge inheritance. But a phone that has to be plugged in just right so it charges is not one of those things. Switch to Verizon and we'll pay off your old phone up to $800 via prepaid MasterCard for a new one on us. Just trade in any phone from our top brands with select unlimited plans. $829.99 purchase with new smartphone line on select unlimited plans. Minimum $90 per month with auto pay plus taxes and fees for 36 months required. Less $830 trade-in slash promo credit applied over 36 months. Trade-in terms apply. Payoff phone requires smartphone purchase and port-in with new smartphone line on select plan. Must provide most recent bill showing payoff amount of eligible phone. Additional terms apply.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.